This is the current federal tax developments for the week of November the 2nd, 2020. Dollars, and I'm coming to you this week again from Phoenix, Arizona, here recording today on Halloween, and we'll be talking about things that have happened this week in the area of federal taxes. Federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your State Society of CPAs. What we're going to be looking at this week will be some of the following topics. First, IRS issued an information letter to a congressman's office regarding the proper treatment of real estate cooperatives and taxes paid on such if you're taking the deduction on Schedule A. We also had an IRS guidance come out on the proper way to handle W-2s this year if you are an employer who has been deferring the FICA wages from September 1st on for your employees. You have the methods that you'll be using, and the bad news for you is, maybe not terribly surprising, is that you're going to have to issue a W-2 and then most likely a W-2C at a later date. We'll also talk about the fact that we have a proposed, at least a purported, SBA form that's going to go to companies or either for-profit, not-for-profit organizations that got a PPP loan in excess of $2 million that will ask them about whether or not their loan was necessary under the law. And remember, we had a big issue about the loans being necessary and what it would take to show that a loan was necessary. We'll talk a bit about how that worked, what's going on there, and what it's going to do in terms of how we're going to handle that going forward. So with that, let's go to our first item. We're going to talk about information letter 2020-0010. It was issued on September 25th and published by the IRS on their website. And the issue here relates the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act's limit on the deduction of state and local taxes. As you may remember, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act stated that you could not claim most taxes on Schedule A, or your Schedule A itemized deductions were going to be limited to $10,000 unless the tax related to a trade or business, in which case it probably shouldn't be on Schedule A, or a 212 activity. But there was a special problem that we kind of needed to get with here, which was, even though the language at 164B6, which is what limits the deduction to $10,000, indicated that limitation applied only to items that were deductible under Section 164. Now, that's something to keep in mind, because a method that we have for holding real estate where, let's say, you're going to have, let's say we have a building, we have a whole bunch of units in the building, and we're going to have it sold to individuals who want to occupy it and have an ownership interest in it, and we have our 40 units in the building. Now, in most of the country, the most likely thing that would happen in that case is that it would be operated as a condominium. In a condominium, each unit holder actually owns their portion of the building, and they own an undivided interest in areas that are considered common areas, normally managed by an association, homeowner association, that manages the common areas for the condominium. But an alternative way of structuring something like that, that actually is allowed in most states, but you see most often in the Northeast, especially in the New York City area, is to operate as a real estate condominium. In a real estate condominium, a corporation will own that building. It will own the building. It will own all the common areas. And if you want to live in a unit in that building and you get the exclusive right to occupy it, you end up having to buy shares in the cooperative corporation. Now, that's great. With the condominium, it's pretty obvious that the property taxes will be assessed directly on the condominium property, and the condominium owner will pay those taxes, and makes perfect sense. It's going to be a tax under 164, a tax that's based on property, and that tax will therefore be deducted on Schedule A. But the problem with the condominium is, of course, the corporation owns the building, so the tax bill is going to go to the corporation. Well, in order to allow that structure, which is just basically an alternative structure using the condominium structure, to be able to not be worse off, because obviously if we have a C corporation there that's supposedly paying taxes and we have shares in it, that would be a big problem. So there's special federal laws in this area. And the one we're talking about specifically is Section 216 of the Internal Revenue Code. Under Section 216, if you own an interest in a qualified residential cooperative and you're assessed its portion of the taxes, which you will be generally in that, you're essentially going to get a deduction for those taxes. So those taxes will come out. Your share of the taxes imposed on the corporation will be deductible on your return on Schedule A. Now, what's unique about this is, of course, the authorization for the deduction are not the two categories mentioned in 164B6, but a special add back in Section 216. So this deduction under 216, we get to be allowed. Now, the key problem is, since the code only said we had a limitation on taxes under 164, and this tax is added under 216, well, does it really get limited to as part of the $10,000 limitation for state and local taxes? And the Blue Book indicated that Congress intended for it to be part of that, and makes some sense because, you know, we're trying to put them on the same basis as if it had been structured as a condominium where you owned the unit and the tax was imposed on the unit. But instead, it's structured as this cooperative structure. But the problem is, as the Blue Book said in the footnote, the law doesn't seem to say it's limited. So it turns out that the Office of Representative Nadler in New York City decided to write to the IRS and ask for this to be answered. Generally, these letters come up quite often based on constituent requests. And the bad news is you probably don't want to ask a question if you might not like the answer. And in this case, the IRS ruled that, and the interesting part of this ruling is they never actually talk about the law. And it's, letters are less formal, and they're not the sort of thing you'd read if you're reading a chief counsel advice or even a service center advice. You don't tend to get as much technicality. But it was kind of interesting that while the IRS says the $10,000 limit applies, the only thing they talked about were congressional intent in the laws underlying this. They never actually looked at the code. And why that's important is because you may remember when we had qualified improvement property, it was pretty clear from the committee reports and other documents that Congress intended in the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act to have qualified improvement property qualify for a 15-year life and bonus depreciation. And I mean, the language is clear in the reports. The reports tell us that's exactly what they meant to do. But as the IRS pointed out, the law as written didn't really accomplish that because that property was still left as real property. And it had to be real property to qualify improvement property, but they forgot to put in any special life for that property. So the IRS said, Congress, tough luck. You wrote the law this way. Even though we know you didn't mean it, we can't interpret it differently. Now, as we all know, as part of the CARES Act, Congress did fix that one. And Congress fixed a couple of other things in the CARES Act. So we had a couple of other glitches, like the fact that they didn't quite properly write the limitation on business losses to not count as net business income, your W-2 wages from your job. That got fixed. But they didn't talk about this at all. But now the IRS has decided here that, oh yeah, the $10,000 limit applies. So where do we stand now? Well, the law is still the law, and obviously the law still applies. And secondly, information letters technically have no standing whatsoever. They don't even, it would appear, they wouldn't even qualify as any form of authority under 6662 for purposes of a substantial authority position. But we do know it's probably going to be a position that if you get examined, you would see an agent pushing. So the problem is you can tell your clients, which I would right now if I had many of these structures, and I don't because I'm practicing in Phoenix. And in my career, I've run into one client who eventually bought into a building that was a co-op in Arizona, but that's the only one I've run into. And that was a number of years ago. The client has now passed away, so we don't have that situation any longer. The catch is, I would tell a client with a cooperative that apparently, you know, I think the law still seems just as mixed up as ever. And the Blue Book is, I believe, correct that a technical correction would be needed to achieve the result of capping it. But I'd also tell them that clearly they intended it to be capped at 10 grand. And I would have to, I think at this point, disclose to them that we do have this letter on the record stating that, you know, IRS writing to a congressman stating that the $10,000 cap applies. So what I tell a client is I can sign the return really either way. Either position is fine by me. If you go the way of claiming the full deduction, there's a really good chance if you're examined, we're going to be asked to defend why that's that way. There's also a decent chance that the agent may not accept our explanation immediately, that we might at a minimum need to go to appeals because I see the agent and their supervisor not liking this position, potentially even coming across us in for letter and saying, no, we got to do it this way. Maybe we could get an appeals. It's possible. But if appeals were to dig in their heels, then you're looking at a tax court issue to go after this. And the problem is a lot of our clients, as I've said before, tend to be wimps on this sort of thing. And so they don't really want any IRS trouble. And you'll find out, especially when you point out that we have this letter now that says, sorry, guys, you're capped at 10 grand. Don't be surprised if a lot of clients want to stay capped at 10 grand. Now, if you have a client who claimed the deduction in excess of the 10 grand, hopefully you did, as I've recommended, tell them that, yeah, there's always a possibility the service will disagree because they've never said anything about this prior to this letter. And then you can talk with the client saying, yes, we could amend and have you pay the tax. And the advantage of that is that if you there's no chance of being examined, that would at least examine for that issue and having penalties assessed, et cetera, because you turned it in before they caught you. You weren't aware you're going to be caught. There was no issues. Now, of course, you can't wait to get an exam letter and then suddenly decide to turn in all this stuff. But the other side of it is it's still as defensible today as it was before. There's nothing more binding on the record than there was prior. So, we're still in the same position. Next up, another little thing that happened this year, you may remember. This is the Form W-2 reporting of Employee Social Security Tax Deferred under Notice 2020-65. This is a notice on the IRS website that was published on October the 30th. As you may remember, the president on August the 8th issued a memorandum that's kind of like an executive order. We can decide. It was interesting. Some things that day were executive orders. Others were memorandums. But legally, they really have no difference. The White House's counsel has ruled years ago. And it held that employers would be allowed to stop withholding the employee portion of FICA, old age, survivor, and disability insurance, the 6.2%, for the period from September 1st to the end of December, under Section 7508's authority to temporarily put off having to pay a tax. But of course, as we also know, that after you do that, when we get into 2021, we're going to have to start withholding this tax again. So we defer it, we don't collect it all the way through the end of the year. Then we get to 2021, and we have to kind of double up on the withholding to catch up the taxes previously withheld. The one thing we had not explained yet was, how do you do W-2s in that case? I mean, what are FICA wages? And, what do you put down for FICA withholding? Because it hasn't been withheld in 2021. Or in 2020, it's going to be withheld in 2021, but the wages occurred in 2020, and we just deferred when we had to pay the tax over. So the IRS has now told us what to do. If you are doing this, now remember, this was all voluntary. So an employer did not have to do this, and in fact, all evidence I've seen so far to date, all my discussion with clients to date, all my discussion with individuals asking if their employer was doing this to date, has shown that aside from the federal government, very, very few employers did this. But if you are an employer that did it, here's what's going to happen. When you do your W-2s initially for 2020, notice I said initially because you're probably not going to like part of this. When you do the initial W-2, you do not change FICA wages. FICA wages will still include what is FICA wages from September 1st through the end of the year, and you report those as FICA wages on the W-2. However, you do not report the FICA wages, the FICA withholding that didn't take place that's been deferred. You know what that is because you're going to have to catch it back, but you don't actually put it on the W-2. So it stays there, right? We do that. So we do the withholding and do it. Now, eventually in 2021, you will manage to have fully recovered the amount that you had not previously withheld. And what you're not going to like at this point is now you've got to file amended W-2s. That'll be a W-2C and a W-3C. So a bunch of W-2Cs and then W-3C. And that will then put the withholding back on the form. So the W-2 you send them at the end of January technically would come in without the extra withholding. Now, this kind of raises a question because we don't have to issue them until the end of January, and we will be beginning to withhold those funds. And that's kind of an interesting question of, well, could you go ahead and have the January withholding? My guess is you really don't get into that issue because then it depends on which day you issued your W-2s as of. So presumably you're just going to issue them based on December 31st numbers. And then when you finally get the total amount recovered, you're going to go ahead and issue a W-2C. Now, you might say, well, why would we need to do that? Here's the problem. Remember, if an employee changes employers during the year, the new employer, even if I had wages paid to me of $3 million, you know, for the first 9 months of the year by my former employer, my new employer has to start FICA withholding over again here on September 1st. So let's say through the end of August, I had $2 million worth of wages paid from my former employer, right? The employer that I left at the end of August. And so I restart. I'm going to restart with FICA wages back at zero. So my new employer is going to withhold FICA again from my check and have to pay FICA on the employer's side of that, which also, as we know, this year is being deferred, but that's totally unrelated. That's another issue that goes back to the original relief provisions early in the year that we had under the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act. So don't worry about that part of it. That part is a whole separate issue. It has nothing to do with this right away. But that extra FICA you're going to withhold from my paycheck for the last 4 months of the year, I can treat that as additional federal withholding. In fact, that's what we do. I recover my overwithheld FICA from the second employer because I went over the FICA limit with the first employer, or I'm going to be over it with combinations. So I've had too much FICA withheld on wages in excess of the maximum for the year. I file a claim. Basically, I put that in additional withholding. But the problem is, until the W-2C gets issued with the revised withholding number on it, I can't claim that over withholding. So I may very well find, and this is where it gets complicated, by the time the new W-2 comes out, it may very well be well after the April 15th due date before I will get everything repaid, and I'll have a W-2C that will enable me to claim the excess FICA. So the same notice does warn employees that they may need to file an amended return as well to make this work if they are in a position where their employer has not been withholding FICA, they've had multiple employers during the year, and they will go over. So have too much withheld, and part of that too much withheld would obviously be at the end of the year is where the big chunk of it comes, and that's going to be because of that September 1st to December 30th, right? That's kind of, and I guess it doesn't really matter when it comes, presumably, because obviously if it was at the beginning of the year that we deferred, we'd still have the same problem that we couldn't stack it up on top. But it's kind of obvious that, yeah, we're going to have a little issue. So again, employers who did this will be doing an amended set of W-2s. That is not optional. Secondly, an employee that changed employers during the year and their employer, any employer they had from September 1st to the end of December that did not withhold FICA, and their total FICA wages combined for all employers during the year by their total wages would go over. So they had over the FICA limit in FICA wages for the year. They're going to have to wait for their W-2C. Hey, you know, one of those things. The good news is most employers ignored this. The bad news is if the employer didn't ignore it, yeah, we got a little bit of an issue. Finally is an issue that I kind of wondered if I should talk about this week, but we actually do have some information on it, and it appears really likely that we've got more information than the SBA has officially said they've given out yet. Let's talk about this. There is right now out there a purported Form 3509 loan necessity questionnaire for profit borrowers. It made the rounds on October 30th is when we started seeing this. This form, this purported form, started showing up on Friday, October 30th in a number of sites. If you go to our website, I've got a link to a copy of that form in PDF form that is on the Politico site. but you can find it other places. And I've checked, all the forms I've found so far are identical. I've actually received a copy of it from another source that was asking some questions about it. You know, I was being asked some questions by a publication about it, if I had any comments. I was actually in a CPE course teaching on Friday, so I couldn't make comments on it. But this form, every copy I've seen so far is identical. Now, the catch is, this part we do know is true. This week in the Federal Register, the Small Business Administration did list a set of forms that are coming out with PPP loans, and many of the ones in the list were ones we've already seen. You know, for the 3508 series forms, all of those things, they have those. But then they listed down here this 3509 and 3510. And the title of the form is exactly what's on this purported, you know, this purported form 3509, that is the 9-page PDF. The title of it does say exactly that, Loan Necessity Questionnaire For-Profit Borrowers. There is a similar one, 3510, is for not-for-profit. That one's also out. Fewer sites have it posted, but it is basically much the same document. Okay, so we know they're going to issue this form, and it's also clear it's going to borrowers who have loans in excess of $2 million, because in the Federal Reserve statement about, you know, going to be issuing these and need OMB numbers, they tell us how many of these forms they expect to get. And it's very clear when they look at this versus forgiveness forms that, and you look at their stats, that these are going to the more than $2 million loans. That much is clear. You know, the total of these two between the not-for-profit and the for-profit, it's basically the number of over $2 million loans. So, and we know those were going to be subject to review. So bottom line, we kind of know what this thing is, and it makes sense. The claim form is going for what we believed it was going to. Clearly, we're going to send this form, whether or not the one I've got and that you can download is the one that exists. You know, it's going to be the actual one that's kind of open. I mean, we don't know if it's a draft. We don't know what it is. The interesting part is it does not say draft, and it has an OMB control number, which suggests it's probably the real one. Now, the other funny part is it still shows an October 31st expiration date, which is amusing because, of course, you know, they issue it the week of October 31st. Now, I've already told us they're going to roll those days forward, so I assume they're going to roll the package forward probably here this evening or somewhere on Monday. We'll see the rolled forward numbers. So we never may actually see the October 31st one posted on their website, but it's been reported by some businesses that the form has already out there and it's being floated to businesses. And yeah, it's in the wild, we're told in some cases. But again, SBA has not said what they're doing. We do know the copies began showing up in various locations on Friday the 30th. And a number of publications have approached the SBA. Specifically, we saw some stories in Tax Analyst or Tax Notes Today Federal. The story in Politico, and both asked the SBA for comment on Friday. You know, is this your form? Is it not your form? You know, what's going on here? And the SBA was totally silent. No response one way or the other. So with the fact that we cannot know for sure, what we have is a 3509 is the actual form. I'd put it this way. It certainly appears to be the form. It makes sense. It's also interesting that, you know, if somebody called up the SBA and said, you know, I got a copy of Form 3512, you know, that is just, you know, you got a $150,000 loan, sign it, and you're forgiven. I suspect they would tell me right away that was bogus. So the fact they're not commenting, you know, there is a very good possibility, I think, that this document, you know, they don't want a lot of attention on it, although they're getting a lot now, whether they like it or not. No, they're going to float it out there, start asking the questions, and they weren't going to push it out early so people could see it. But of course, copies have gotten out there. So here's what the catch is for this form. Let's talk a little bit about what the form is, how it'll be used, and what's going on. Okay. Now, this form is the one we're seeing is a 9-page form. The first page is a basic description of the form and what it's for. Pages 2 through 8 contain sections first that are in questionnaire form, and it has what they call a business activity assessment, as well as a liquidity assessment. And it is clear, as we're told in this, that the purpose of this form is to determine if you were basically, was this firm necessary for your business? Remember, we had the big to-do with Ruth Chris, and we had Ruth Chris, we had Potbelly, and we also had Shake Shack, were the three that got all that publicity. We had Marco Rubio on, we had every, you know, Marco Rubio complaining about it. We had the SBA saying all these things, you had to show the need. We had that whole payback date. Okay, all that kept going, and then we got all the stories about small businesses panicking and sending the money back, even though they were going to have to close their doors because they were afraid of this. And then the SBA backed off and said, if you're below $2 million, we're going to assume you need it. Don't worry. You want it to show you need it, but we'll check the over two. So that whole fiasco, now that all nicely died back in May, but now it's coming back up again because we're going to apply for loans. And I think the other problem is politically, is now we're going to probably start seeing stories again in the press about companies that, you know, appear to be questionable about whether they need the loan. The whole issue of needing the loans going to come back up again with these stories of, you know, public companies that got the loan, didn't pay it back, and now want full forgiveness. And yeah, we know how this is going to go. So in any event, what ends up happening is the SBA has put this form out. And they tell us that they, you know, basically we're going to be reviewing these loans to maximize program integrity and protect taxpayer resource. And they're saying, when you send this form out, you know, we basically want you to respond. Now, they're not being the most reasonable in timeframes here. You will get this document. You will have 5 days to respond. So if you got a PPP loan, and if the loan was more than $2 million, what they're telling you is you are going to get this document. So you might want to look at this document. You know, and I've got a link to the copy on Politico because I believe that'll probably stay around the longest. You know, I don't, it's not a risk of moving somewhere very quickly. So I've got the link back to their copy. And as I said, I verified that copy other places. So if this is a, you know, a fraud copy, it's everything got the fraud got to everybody. So we're there. And secondly, there's not much damage, I guess, if it's a fraud copy, because it's not really going to hit you until your bank hands you this thing and says you got to fill it out. At which point then, yeah, you'll know it's not a fraud. And because you only have 5 days to respond and there are materials you got to get together for it, I would say I'd start getting the materials together. And hey, if it turns out that you don't have to do it, that's great. But if you do, remember, you're going to have a 5-day clock. The SBA also warns us that if you do not complete it and provide the necessary supporting documentation, that the SBA may simply decide to make a determination that you were ineligible for the loan, meaning you cannot get the forgiveness, and theoretically, if you weren't eligible, there might be questions about whether you get the 1% interest rate, whether you get the 2-year or 5-year repayment term, or whether you're supposed to give the money back right away. So as I said, we'd probably prefer not to have that happen to us. So we'd like to not have the 5-year rule. Now, the interesting part about this, and I should say, another interesting thing about this, you know, is this loan form legit? Well, we have a post from Eric Azurian of the AICP. Sorry, Eric, I mispronounced your name. He posted on Twitter late on Friday, specifically this: AICPA is in the process of following up with Treasury SBA on PPP loan necessity 3509, 3510 forms to better understand. The forms have not yet been officially released. We don't think the information requested is in line with the intent of the PPP Act. Bottom line, the AICPA is telling us indirectly that they have concluded the form is legitimate. And there are real concerns about the questions being asked on this form. Let's talk about what's being asked. First, we're going to get into the section called the Business Activity Assessment. Now, remember, if your loan was less than $2 million, right, and as any related group, you're not above $2 million, you're not going to have to worry about this. So this is for those above $2 million. So don't freak out if you got a, you know, $800,000 loan. This is not your problem, unless you're with, you know, unless you have related companies and you're going to all together go over $2 million. Let's assume you're below $2 million. You know, if you're below, don't worry about this. If you're above $2 million, here's the questions you got to answer. And they don't tell us right off what they're going to do with this data. They're going to ask you to provide this data. And again, many people are making conclusions about, well, you'd only ask for this if you were going to take the position of why. So let's go forward. You're going to have to provide revenues for the second quarter of 2020 and revenues for the second quarter of 2019. If you are a seasonal business, and I still find it funny, we've never defined what seasonal business is. But if you are a seasonal business, you can decide instead to send the third quarter of both years. So we're going to have the identical quarters from 20 and 19. Okay. If you were not in business in the second quarter of 2019, you will instead send the second quarter of 19 and the first quarter, or second quarter of 20 and the first quarter of 20. If you cannot use third quarter if you were not in business for the second quarter of last year. You have to go ahead and swap over. Or put it this way, it really says, if you use third quarter of 2020, you've got to send third quarter of 19. So if you started business in the third quarter of 19, then I guess you could send third quarter 19 and third quarter 20 if you claim you're seasonal. But you might think that may not look so good because, of course, probably if you just started out, your revenue will not decline. Now, the presumption of a lot of people is a revenue decline would be something they're going to look for to see if you had a need. They're also going to ask you information, right? Were you ever subject to a state or local order to shut down from March 13th, the date that the COVID national emergency was declared, through the end of your PPP loan forgiveness covered period? So they're going to ask you about that. Was there a state or local shutdown order? If there was, what was the locality? What was the nature of it? Were you shut down or were you forced to modify operations? Now, I think a lot of businesses are going to answer yes to those, depending upon your type of business. So when they were talking about things like, were you forced to, you know, put in a change employee setups? Were you forced to reduce capacity? Were you forced to move your services outside? You know, what were you required to do by the state? Secondly, because in some cases it wasn't required, but you did it voluntarily, they're going to repeat those same two questions for a voluntary shutdown or modification, asking about the same issues. Now, they are going to say if you voluntarily shut down, they're going to ask you why if you weren't ordered to. And they do end up giving you reasons like, you know, there was COVID-19, or I should say COVID-19 employee positives. I know that happened to some restaurants here nearby in the Arcadia area here in Phoenix. We had a whole bunch for a while where they got COVID positive when restaurants were allowed to reopen initially in Arizona. And so they would shut down, right? You know, because everybody got freaked out when they've had positive employees. So if you did that, or maybe, you know, your supply chain was killed, because maybe you relied on products being made someplace where their business was shut down because it was not essential. So even though you were never ordered to shut down, you couldn't get the products to keep operating. So, you know, you give that information for a voluntary shutdown or modification. Also on this list, did you make any capital improvements that were not related to COVID-19 after March 13th and obviously before the end of the loan improvement period? If you did, how much cash was used for those, right? Then you've got to do some information. Tell us what industry you're in, the NAICS six-digit code. You might expect that the SBA believes some businesses, you know, probably shouldn't have been negatively impacted. Others probably were. You know, if your business was, you know, wholesaling certain protective gear, as long as you could get it, you probably had a really good year. You know, if you were Amazon just had, you know, kind of a very, very good best quarter ever for revenue because people were buying from them. So they're going to ask you about that because that could be important. And they do give you a spot there. There are a couple of spots in where you can describe what happened. They're always limited to 1,000 characters. And they give you one more 1,000 character block just in case you want to explain a bit more about any of your answers. But do it succinctly because 1,000 characters really aren't that many. Got very few to go. What it means is they're going to ask the banks to input this on their website. And yeah, they only have small input blocks. So yeah, don't get really wordy is what they're telling you. Now, in addition, there is a liquidity assessment. And for this, and there are this needs a lot more documentation. We'll talk about what documentation you need, but this needs a lot more. You have to tell what your cash and cash equivalents were at the end of the quarter before the date you applied for your loan. So we're going to be the last calendar quarter that ended before you sent in your application. So what's your cash and what's your cash equivalent as of that date? Also, from the date, during that period, did you, during the period the loan is here, you know, we've got from the start of this thing to the loan, did you make any distributions to owners, dividends, other distributions, for anything other than paying estimated taxes via, for the owners to pay estimated taxes on income from a flow through? And in fact, they actually have a limitation there on the computation for max amount you could use for that. That's really going to be tied. You have to show it relates to this year's earnings, 110% of last year's earnings, or a ratio based on last year's tax. Yeah, you know, basically, you've got to show things like that, pay estimated taxes. Interesting aside, apparently, if you made a distribution to pay the taxes on 2019's income that you may have figured after March 13th, and you made that distribution after March 13th, that apparently would be a problem distribution purpose. At least we presume it means problem. And of course, if you did make any of these distributions, you're going to tell them the amount, right, that you made. They also want to know, did you prepay any debts from March 13th through the end of the period? Did you make, so essentially, did you pay any amounts on principal in excess of what was legally required of you to pay during the period you had the PPP loan? Probably a reasonable assumption they're looking for refinancing. They're looking for people that may have said, hey, 1% interest rate, that's way lower. I'm going to pay off this piece of equipment and just go ahead and, you know, do the 1% interest. That would be a much better deal. And it'll be forgiven anyway because I'm going to pay payroll. So, no, they don't want to do that, right? Now, the next one is really interesting. This one did come really out of left field. Because, you know, we knew we weren't supposed to refinance loans. And, you know, we kind of had this idea that and we weren't supposed to be using it to pay for distributions to owners, do other things, supposed to be using it for the reason. So maybe I understand the first two. But the next one's kind of interesting. Were any employees paid an amount during the period? So what, when you, during the period from, you know, that we have the loan outstanding, did you pay amounts to any employees that if you annualize that payout of what they got during that period, would come up to an annual payment of more than $250,000? And if you did, how many employees and how much in total did you pay to those people, you know, that annualized in excess of $250,000? And then we repeat that same question asking about owners. How many owners were paid in excess of $250,000? Now, of course, presumably this gives an implication that they believe you should have cut the salaries of those people and not paid them an amount that was in excess of $250,000 a year, you know, that you should have been paying a reduced amount. And if, you know, if the big wigs weren't taking a cut, that indicates that it really wasn't necessary for you to maintain operations. That's presumably an implication you're going to get from this. Certainly, the implications from this are kind of an interesting problem. Now, also for liquidity assessment, do you have equity securities that are traded on a national security exchange? So kind of indirectly, are you a public company? Is there a public company that owns more than 20% interest in your company? If your company is not a public company, what is your net worth as of the quarter before? Now, by the way, if you're a public company, they're going to ask you about your capitalization. If you're a non-public company, they're going to ask you about the net worth on your financial for the quarter before you applied, right? All of those things. So we're looking at that. If you have public company shareholders, they're going to ask you about that, the public company's net worth. Okay, these are all considered to be source of funds. Is there a parent company that owns more than 50% of you? If there is, more detail about that parent company needs to be involved. Or is any owner a private equity, venture capital, or hedge fund? That's considered to be suspicious by them. I love these suspicious things, right? We've got that. Are you an affiliate or subsidiary of a foreign state-owned entity or an actual foreign state, you know, division? Because if you are, that's also to be flagged. Did you receive any other assistance under the CARES program, like an EIDL grant? Or you remember there was a Main Street loan program. There were some special deals for airlines. I don't know that an airline could ever qualify for this, but maybe a really small airline qualify for this program too. And then again, we close out our liquidity with, again, another place where if you got any, want to explain anything, you know, write cryptic 1,000 characters. You can explain any of your answers. Now, once you're done, the authorized person will be certifying, right, on this. And these are kind of your standard certifications, very similar to what we had on our application form initially, what we have on our forgiveness form, that, you know, the person assigned says they have the authority to sign and submit this questionnaire on behalf of the borrower. They certify it's all true, correct, and they understand if they're lying, they're going to be in jail for a while. So understanding all those things. Then you also send in supporting information. So first thing is you've got to send in detail to support your revenue calculations for the quarters that you were asked to submit for your business activity assessment. So we need backups for all of that information. We also need backup information on the cash and the cash equivalents that were available, you know, at the end of the quarter before you applied for the loan. Got to give that information. If you made distributions to owners other than for estimated taxes, you have to provide information on that to back that up. You also need to provide information on any debt prepayments you made that you paid in excess of what you were required to make. That gives information about all of that stuff, loan, etc., prepayments, the loan, the terms, all those things. Then you give us information on the compensation paid to any employees that annualized up to over $250,000, as well as information on the owners. So I'd assume you would identify which of the employees were owners, and that would be how you do it. All that information, remember, you have to finish the questionnaire, assemble all the information, and return it to your lender within 5 days. Fail to do that, and voila, you may find out that your loan, you're considered ineligible for the loan, which, as I said, at least conceivably could mean they could ask for the whole thing back right now with interest at a rate much higher than 1%. So this brings us to, okay, what exactly does this mean? And there's a lot of articles that have been written online about this particular issue. Tax Notes Today Federal had a really good article that discussed this and, you know, kind of goes into some of the implications. And I do mention that. I quote from that article and quote from one person who was cited in the article, you know, that kind of talks about, you know, the problem is that, you know, the real question is, are they changing the rules after the fact? And what we mean by that is, as is pointed out in the article in Tax Notes Today Federal by the first commentator, is, you know, the issue was when you got the loan, you indicated uncertainty at the date you applied for the loan. Now, obviously, we didn't know if you applied for the loan early on, and most borrowers did. It was before the end of the second quarter. We did not know what second quarter revenue was going to be until after the loan was issued, right? So we suddenly decide what it was. Now, a couple of problems there. Number one, it was an unknown number. It was future. And the whole point of this was uncertainty. Uncertainty means we don't know if it will or won't be bad, right? There's uncertainty. And secondly, as was pointed out, because a lot of times, you know, you may be billing something, you have work that's done, it's billed, and the payments are coming in the second quarter. So the cash flow for revenue still looks fine in quarter two. Your problem is going to be in quarter three because people stopped continuing projects and shut down in quarter two. So you still were collecting receivables, you know, as long as your customers were still able to pay, but you weren't generating new receivables. So your actual decline could come in a later period. It's also an objection. And as we said, uncertainty means uncertainty. Uncertainty means that, you know, we don't know what the future holds. As is pointed out, all of these answers seem to be looking at what happened afterward in many cases and using that as a proxy for whether or not there was uncertainty. And, you know, that's kind of, well, I don't know. You know, for instance, prior to the baseball season, it was uncertain if the Dodgers would win the World Series this year and be the world, you know, be the series champion. And I would say that, yes, it's a very plausible statement to say that was a high level of uncertainty that the Dodgers would be World Series champion. The fact that they turned out to be World Series champion doesn't mean that, oh, you're wrong. It was totally certain. You know, back when we had the COVID shutdown and back when we came up with the way to play baseball, that the Dodgers were going to win everything. There was no question. It was obvious. It's clear. I'd say there was still a lot of uncertainty about the Dodgers being the World Series champion right up until they actually won the World Series. I think you kind of got the same problem here. So the problem is, though, we're using hindsight. Now, obviously, part of the reason for this is I am certain that there will be articles that come out that point out company XYZ, you know, got the PPP loan. They had employees who are making millions. You know, they kept getting their money, right? And then they got this $5 million loan. They're not having to pay back, and they didn't seem to ever suffer, et cetera, et cetera. And so I understand their concern that they don't want that embarrassing situation hitting the press. But it is a problem, I think, for some clients who have it. And also, if you are the outside auditor, I know this is tax, but if you're like the outside accountant and you have to issue a review report, compilation report, or more likely at these numbers, an audit, you've got a lot of uncertainty now, right? Will they be, and I think that creates a real question regarding around that loan because of what's being asked for here until such time as the SBA clarifies. Will we get these documents done as final forms? Maybe. They may even be final forms by the time you read this because the SBA has been known to post things on the weekend. So maybe they come final, I assume, because they're October 31st. At this point, they'll wait and put them out after they roll the date with everything else. So take a look, but you probably want to, if you have a more than $2 million PPP loan, I would strongly suggest you go to our website, go to the article, get the link to the form that's on the Politico site, and just start reading it and, figure out how you're going to answer things and what's going to happen, how you're moving forward. Anyway, it's interesting. Like I say, we keep getting PPP loan information and it dribbles out, and this is the latest dribble out. Again, remember, we know these two form numbers are coming. That has already been totally conceded in the Federal Register by the SBA. What we do not know for absolute certain is that this form is it, but there are a lot of people who are in the know, who should be in the know and understand, including the AICPA, who are certainly acting as if this is a real form. So my take right now, I would work as if it's probably real and at least consider how you're going to, the way to get the information together in 5 days if you have to, because if this thing is just dropping on people out of the blue, you may have no warning before they drop it in and you've got 5 days to fill the thing out. Again, we're still going to be doing the conferences this week, so I want to remind you that if you want to check the Arizona Society of CPAs, I'll be at the Arizona Federal Tax Institute. I'll do a federal tax update other than COVID items. Then I'll also do a session for COVID-19 tax issues. Kind of split the two. So I have two sessions. They'll each be, as I recall, 75 minutes. And so we'll go over the basics of there in those two cases. I'll do one session I do on the 4th, one I do on the 6th. The conference runs for 3 days. I'll also be doing sessions for the Washington Society of CPAs for their Pacific Tax Institute. My sessions there will be on Friday. I'll be doing one session that is the CARES impacts on net operating losses and other losses, and then also a session on taxation of debt forgiveness. Again, these can be signed up at the relevant state society websites. We're going to have a lot more CP courses coming in the near future. I will be this week doing PPP loan forgiveness course for the Hawaii Society of CPAs on Tuesday, and I'll be doing it for Idaho on Thursday. So we'll have kind of a pair of those courses. And we're going to be seeing a lot more things happening. So yeah, could be fun. Again, this has been Current File Tax Developments for this week of November the 2nd of 2020. You can email me, Ed Zahrs at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Check our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where you can pick up on documents or new developments during the week. We'll talk about them next week on the program, but we'll probably post them a bit during the week, so you can check there. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my handle there is at Ed Zahrs. I tend to post links there when we do get new developments, or I retweet items when others have posted new developments, new items that I think might be of interest to you. I also monitor the Connect Set websites for the societies of CPAs for Arizona, Illinois, Minnesota, New Jersey, and Washington. So if you're a member of one of those societies, you participate on those Connect sites, I will try to look in, and if I think I can help and I have time, I will try to respond to those. Otherwise, we look forward to this week. Hey, gang, it's election night. We'll have election day coming up. Maybe you'll listen to this after the election so you know who won. Maybe we won't know who won a week from now. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. Remember, when I talk about who won, the key issue is going to be not just who wins the presidency, but which party has control of each House of Congress. The House kind of appears to be no question. The control's not changing because that would have to be a really, really big change. But, you know, the Senate is probably open to question, really open to question. You still have a question on the presidency. So once we know the answer of what the government's going to look like in January, we may then start considering what, if any, changes we may be looking at. So I may talk about that. If we have clarity by next weekend, I may actually talk about any proposed changes that appear likely. And obviously, the most likely reason I would be able to do that is if we had the situation, in fact, it's probably the only way I'd record it, is if we had the situation of the presidency, you know, former Vice President Biden wins the presidency, the Democrats take control of the Senate, therefore, suddenly Biden's proposal becomes a possibility. If we find out that, you know, if that doesn't happen, then most likely there's a good chance that A, obviously he's going to win the presidency, his proposal is kind of a really who cares. And if he wins the presidency, but the Senate remains in Republican control, we're going to get a vastly different bill than what he's talking about. Even if he wins, to be honest, we'll probably get a somewhat different bill. But if in fact, so we'll see if it makes sense. Again, 4 years ago, because we did have total control, you know, Republican president coming in, Republican Senate, Republican House, because that was the structure we were coming into, you know, it was going to be full control. 4 years ago, I did look at the president-elect's tax proposal. And so I'd probably consider doing the same thing this year if those facts, you know, now come up with the Democrats being the one in total control rather than the Republicans. I would just repeat 4 years ago, I'll not repeat and tell you Donald Trump's proposal, but you understand what I mean. I talk about a proposal. Otherwise, we'll just probably do developments. So take care. I enjoyed, you know, make sure you check in next week. We'll talk to you again when we're going to be giving a week's worth of current federal tax developments.